Okay, this is Bob Dobbs, and it's December 22nd, 2016, and this is part 7 in our conversation with Dennis Young. Dennis Young is the Professor Emeritus of Art History at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. We start off this series looking at his essay, Painting and Its Paradigms, which can be read at dennis-young.ca. But we've moved more into the 20th century, which that article does not cover, and we've been exploring the antecedents of surrealism, and then we moved into surrealism, and we're going to continue. Dennis lays out the pattern where he divides, in general, painters as we moved into the 20th century into three historical groups. There's the dadaists and futurists who are allied with poets. There are the abstract painters who are allied with architects. And then there are the pure painters such as Picasso and Matisse who are not allied with either poets nor architects. So, Dennis, you have a little introduction before we get into some new material, a bit of reminder. Let's hear that.
I thought that considering the material that we dealt with in our last conversation, that I would just spend the first 5 minutes today reminding the listener, and then I would go into some new material that concentrates on surrealism, but does not really do very much for the painters, because they are very difficult to handle without you having some kind of reproduction that you can show, because surrealism wasn't just one thing. Although much of the painting was, so to speak, sprang from several things. And those several things were something to do with the mind and the way in which in the late 19th century, as we said last time, was beginning to be seen by lots of people who were not poets or painters or anything else, but were really doctors. So what I thought I would do before we begin to speak about the surrealists is just to remind everyone that we did mention this young poet called Arthur Rimbaud, and a letter that he wrote to his teacher when he was only 16, which we found to be very impressive. He speaks as if he's 45 with his knowledge. And how he's acquired it, goodness knows. But, of course, the man was a genius. There's no question about that. I'll start to read little bits for a minute or so that come from the piece he wrote to his schoolmaster. And he's come to the point where he's talking about I, the letter I, and its relationship to him. He says, I is someone else. And the example of that he gives is this. If brass wakes up as a trumpet, it's not its fault. This is obvious to me. I witness the birth of my thought. I watch it. I listen to it. I draw a stroke on the bow. The symphony begins to stir in the depths or springs onto the stage. And then he goes on to say, and this relates to quite a bit of discussion that had been going on for 100 years in Europe, I say that one must be a seer, S-E-E-R. That's someone who has the ability to look into the future and tell you what will happen. Or make oneself a seer. The poet becomes a seer through a long, immense, and reasoned derangement of all the senses. All shapes of love, suffering, madness. He searches himself. He exhausts all poisons in himself to keep only the quintessences. And there we will leave it.
And he's writing that at 16 years old.
He wrote that at 16 years old. Furthermore, well, I'll read just a little bit more later on in the same letter. He says that one of the things he will do is to find a language, which, of course, will be a poetry language. Moreover, speech being thought, the time for a universal language will come. Only an academician, deader than a fossil, could complete a dictionary in any tongue. Weak people who might begin to think about the first letter of the alphabet and would jump into madness. So he doesn't like the old teachers at all.
Dennis, what kind of education is he getting? Is he reading Wordsworth or Edgar Allan Poe? What would a 15-year-old be reading that might give him such ideas?
I would say, of course, he's in Paris.
Yeah.
I would say that he's going to a very good school. And one of the things that in those days everyone would have to do would have been to study Latin and Greek. It's that kind of thing which he would have got at school. It may have been cut rather narrowly for that, where they would spend a lot of time on being able to translate Latin prose or write Latin prose. The same can be said of Greek, the Greek language, and the Greek thinkers, of course, so that he would have been in touch with that. But at 16, I assume he had been jumped forward to two or three classes because he learned it so quickly. Yeah. I don't know much about his actual existence. I don't think he had a father. I think his mother was very much a disciplinarian. I wanted to write a little piece about his mother as a rather hard kind of woman who wanted some response from her children every time she spoke to them. But I didn't get very far with it. I think it would be called something like Arthur, where are you? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
She didn't want to let him out of her sight, but he didn't regard her of any importance, and he certainly, within a year, was in the center of Paris rather than in the outskirts, and he was meeting with some of the great poets of the period, especially Verlaine, with whom he had a homosexual relationship within a few months.
I see.
What can one say about that? I'm not sure what to say. It would seem that he had. He certainly traveled with Verlaine. I don't know well enough the whole poetry of Rimbaud to know whether any of it actually refers to any kind of emotional relationship. But they had quarrels. Very like people who would have that kind of relationship. That's the best I can say. He does say in this very letter something about women, which is very interesting because it's certainly fairly new. He writes, "When woman's infinite bondage is broken, when she lives for herself and by herself, man, hitherto abominable, having given her leave, she will be a poet. Women will find unknown things too. Will her world of ideas differ from ours? She will find strange, unfathomable, repulsive, delightful things. We shall take them, and we shall understand them." I mean, this is writing the prose of a person incredibly sensitive to the bigger issues of life, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. And what year is that?
It was in 1871.
Is he aware of the Paris Commune, which is around 1871?
Oh, I should think so, very much so,
okay.
Yes. I would think he's very alive to it. But this is my thought.
Yes.
I vaguely in my head from years ago, I have the impression that he had to make his way through the lines of the competence.
Right.
In the, it's not a revolution, really. It's a
strike.
An insurrection, isn't it?
Yeah.
But he had to, he had to get permission to go through the lines, to get to the center of Paris from where he lived.
Yes.
And try to meet the people whose work he has read, but whom he had never met. Now, that was in 71 then. 3 years later, he was basically ending his days as a poet. He had written everything he wanted to write, and within a year or two further, he left Europe and went to Africa, where he spent a lot of time, and I'm not sure what he did all the time. I think he was connected to mining for some outfit back in France. But he made a comment on poetry. He said, and this may have been written in a letter, but it's certainly a famous line of his to quote, which is, merde pour la poésie, shit for poetry.
Hmm.
And he's gone. And he never wrote again.
Is he well known before he leaves Paris?
No, I don't think so. It's his schoolmaster who kept all the letters.
Yes.
And I'm not sure how soon it was before any of his poetry was actually in print. I do know that this schoolmaster, who must have been a very good schoolmaster, kept his letters, realizing, I guess, you know, the command of things that his student had. And he, in the end, did see that all his works were published. But at what point, I'm not at all sure.
Is the schoolmaster's name Bachet?
Yes, I think you're right.
Yeah, good. I think we talked about it in the last recording.
Yeah. Yes. Now, this is, what we're talking about here is something he wrote 17 years before the great Pierre Janet, who was a psychologist of incredible understanding and writing various books that joined in the books that had been just beginning, earlier than that perhaps, to point out that people with mental illness were often being treated far too grossly. Now, we did go into that just a little bit last time.
Yes.
And that there should be some sense that they're not insane. A lot of the time, they're just ordinary people. But the book he published in 1889 had the title L'Automatism Psychologique, The Automatism. This word automatism is one that the surrealists picked up.
But not when it was published, many years later, 30 years later.
Yes, the date was 1889 when it was published.
Right, but the surrealists don't pick up on this book until after World War I?
Yes, right, after World War I.
Yeah.
Well, whether they picked up on it, I'm not sure, but you know, there was no surrealism before World War I for them to bother with it. I mean, as they began to form and formulate their thought, the group of people who became surrealists, no doubt, found the writings of Janet and others of importance, were something they had to get familiar with. Now, Janet had also created a word that the surrealists used, and that was, he called the type of writing that he sometimes saw them do as automatic, so that there was another word for them to come to terms with, and he had witnessed much automatic talking, even by patients.
Oh, yeah?
Paired it with the splitting of consciousness in his experiments in automatic writing. He also realized that mediums wrote without being conscious of what they were doing. So mediums were not listed really as insane or anything of the kind. They were people who didn't see the inside of an asylum at all. He found, that is to say, Janet, J-A-N-E-T, Janet found that mediums shared with hysterics, people who suffered from hysteria, the disintegration of personal perception and the formation of several personalities which succeeded one another. Well, we could go on and on, and I don't want to do that. I just wanted to say that there were Janet's books, and there were others, waiting for the surrealists to become very interested in them, in the same way that young man, Rambo, probably come to by his own self-examination.
Would Janet know about Blavatsky and the Theosophists?
I should think so. I mean, I give him credit for knowing pretty well everything that was going on in France, at any rate, at that time. Whether how many languages he read, I don't know. But Blavatsky was all over the place. And certainly there's every reason to believe that he knew of Blavatskyism, if you like. Let's put it that way. And then we turned to the earliest mention of the word surrealist. Sur, meaning above, and realism, meaning the commonplace idea. But this is above the commonplace. It's surrealism.
Okay.
And it was in a program note for the theater piece that we know of as Parade,
yes,
or Parade. Now, just to qualify that just a little bit, the Parade was something that in Paris and in France in general, I think, you would see in front of certain theaters, trying to get people to come in and see the play or whatever. They would stand outside and parade themselves a bit to encourage people to join them, pay some money and come in.
Yes.
So Parade is that kind of thing. And we went into the amazing number of well-known names that were associated with that particular play. I won't go into whom. That can rest where it is.
I remember there was Picasso, Nassine, Satie, and Cocteau. I think there are four names right there.
Yes, four or five there are. Yeah. Everyone is amazed when they hear all these famous names.
Would they have been out on the sidewalk, you know, trying to get people to come in?
Oh, no. I don't think so at all. Because the substance of the play is a parade, a parade. So, I mean, what they would do, I guess, I've never seen it, but what they would have done is appear on stage and march around, or I'm not sure what they would do, but it could have been a little bit odd, and it would have been, I think, fascinating to see. They would be playing Satie's music, of course.
Right. I get a McLuhan idea from this. As you move into the electric extension of tactility, then kinetic space in McLuhan's pattern becomes an art form. So Parade is starting to wake up and notice the body moving about in the busy cities and making an art form of it.
Yes, you could say that, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't think it would have been used in the great theaters in uptown Paris, but in the smaller theaters, I think it would be quite common, especially in those that were a bit like a circus. That was very common in circuses.
Right.
People who would be performing came out and did a little bit of number.
Would that be a French variation on vaudeville with more emphasis on circus activity, circus gestures?
I'm not sure. I didn't quite catch your point. I'm sorry.
You talked about the circus performers. I'm wondering if the French brought in circus aspects, whereas the British in London did vaudeville, something different. You know, vaudeville, the singing.
I don't know enough about the history of the theatre, but we mustn't forget that the theatre has had a long history in Europe, and right from the 17th century onwards, some of the great writers for the theatre lived in the 17th century.
Yes.
So here we could go a long way off track, I'm afraid,
yeah,
discussing this. But just let me say one thing, which is that very often, for instance, in Versailles, in the big palaces of all the great nobles, there would be a theatre. And they would be sitting on the stage. The great lords and ladies would actually sit on the stage. So it must have been a damn nuisance, you know, for the players. But they, on the other hand, it would be a nuisance for people living today. But in those days, they were maybe well up to it. And maybe the lords and ladies stopped chatting away. I can't imagine what it would be like if people were trying to act within 3 feet of people having an argument. But let's pass on, because the next thing I just wanted to mention from last time, I want to mention a couple of things, but is the appearance of Guillaume Apollinaire. In 1917, he came up with the word surréaliste. And I'm not sure whether it was for Perrade or not. It may well have been. He wrote a play of his own, of course, and that he called Les Mamelles de Tiresias, The Tits of Tiresias. I think we mentioned it last time, and I'm not going to spend as long as we've just taken.
Right.
But it should be understood that it was a ridiculous play, of course. Tiresias, from the Greek period, was one who wanted to experience both being a woman and a man.
Hmm.
And so this is what the play is about. But the play is really a comic play. However, he put into brackets afterwards a surrealist drama. So there was a surrealist drama around 1917-18 called The Tits of Tiresias. And I remember saying last time that he must have been with a man playing Tiresias, because when he comes on the stage, at some point he opens his shirt and what had seemed to be the breasts of a woman were really just balloons, and they float off into the air. So, I mean, that's the amusing part about it.
Yes.
So, I'm just trying to make the point that he used a surrealist drama. And here's the word. So, here's the word coming again. And he is very well known in the city. He's among the best known of the people who look after the art criticism and the poetry. And I'm trying to think of the most simple word.
What's the definition?
Someone who writes about dirty sex.
Pornographer?
Pornographer. So he made a lot of money as a pornographer, and then he was free to do his thing with the art of Paris. His motto, he said, was, I astonish. Now, I astonish is something that had been in the literature for 200 years. Astonishment was a word they applied to something that took you out of yourself, so to speak. You would forget you were sitting in your seat. You would just be hypnotized by what you saw. And there'd been a lot of writing about this in the theater and, indeed, in some ways, about the visual arts. Anyway, this astonishment was something that the surrealists made a key. And to some degree, other people liked it too. The Fauves, the Cubists, the Orphists used it. We also said that surrealism began slowly, and it came up following Dada. as the war ended, the First World War ended, and the Dadaists began to feel that they had said what they had to say. They sneered, so to speak, at the whole war and everything about it, and particularly the people in high places. But there's a point beyond which they felt, well, we've done our bit. And they either gave up or they went on doing something which slowly changed more or less into surrealism, although they seem to have just disappeared. One or two very daring things they did. So there was a period between the end of the war and the getting together of these few poets and painters in which they weren't looking to be a new movement. They didn't quite see what to say about joining up and making something of it. Historians generally call this period, 2 or 3 years, the epoch flu, the period of sort of liquidescence that was waiting for someone to do something. And in the end, the person who did that was Breton.
Yes.
And his point was that one of the reasons why the Dadaists had disappeared, in a way, was that they found themselves being looked upon as a movement or something, and that was the last thing they wanted to do. They didn't want to join in the theater gang or even the painting gang. They were extraordinary people, and they did extraordinary things, and could easily have invited being shot or killed by some of the far right in Paris.
Yes.
But it was Breton who began to say, this is ridiculous. Art doesn't need to stop just because a war is over. With that in mind, they began to look for a new way to produce painting or poetry. And then we get the sudden appearance of their journal. And they called it simply, they didn't say it's the journal of anything, they said just the Surrealist Revolution, La Révolution Surréaliste.
Hmm.
And on the first page, we did read that out last week, this is what they said. The pursuit of knowledge having nowhere to go, the intellect having nothing to contribute, the dream alone makes liberty available to man. Thanks to the dream, death is no longer something obscure, and the direction that life takes is a matter for indifference. And he goes on to say, whoever it is who's writing this, I'm not sure that it is Breton. I think I checked that out last time. He says, we live, we die, and what part does our will play in all that? It seems people do away with themselves as if dreaming. It is not a moral question that we pose. And this is the question they leave with people. Is suicide a solution?
Mm.
Reply to the Bureau of Surrealist Research. Well, it's a question of how much of a real research bureau this was, but people were encouraged to do something. And in the second edition, they actually did have replies. Whether they made them up themselves is not clear. This went on until they became interested in communism.
Oh.
And when they did, they changed everything. And they said now their journal would be the journal at the service of the revolution. And they became very interested in the Russians and so on. In the first of the second numbers of the new idea, they called themselves to their comrades, which is a typical communist thing to do. If the imperialists declared war on the Soviets, our position, same as French Communist Party at Third International. Oh, wait a minute. I must make it clear that they sent this, or they published it in the first page, as if it were a telegram. So the word stop comes in all the time. So I read it with the stops.
Right.
If the imperialists declare war on the Soviets, our position, same as French Communist Party at Third International, stop. We at your disposal as intellectuals or in any other way, stop. We would not presume to suggest our role in today's situation of unarmed confrontation. We believe it is useless to wait to supply our special offering. So they're going to get caught up at that point, and there's going to be all kinds of differences that appear depending on what they're really being expected to do.
Mm.
Now, I thought it might be as well to concentrate on Breton, because by concentrating on Breton, you do have a lot of other people brought in and a lot of the material. So this is what I plan to do, but I don't plan to avoid, for instance, speaking about the way in which new ideas for making paintings occurred, and we'll deal to that when we come to it.
Okay.
In 1914, he was drafted. This is André Breton, and he was born in 1896, so he was just 18. And he was drafted into the army, but he had this good sense to get himself somehow into the medical side of things. So he became a medical orderly. And he may have known Apollinaire by this time. Apollinaire was editing a journal called the Soirée de Paris, and he may well have seen it. He was a very audacious young man, so he may have gone to see Apollinaire. He met Jacques Vacher, and we did talk about him last time. Vacher's iconoclasm, his contempt for orthodox literature and so on, and his final suicide, in which he said he would take someone with him when he suicided, and he did. He took a friend with him and gave them both an overdose of one of the drugs that they had been taking. Now, because he was a medical lawyer, he claimed to have practiced Freudian techniques on patients. Now, that's interesting, because he didn't speak a word of German, and there was not, at that time, a translation of anything Freud had written. But that is what he said, and that is something that we have to think of Breton always, exaggerating his powers.
Mm.
He wrote poetry, got some of it published, and met one of the great poets of the time. And in 1917, he saw the Apollinaire play, The Tits of Tiresias, and must have read the program and seen the words. Apollinaire died the following year, and Breton claimed to have known him, so it almost certainly that it was to do with either the journal or with the play. In fact, when he met with some of the poets, I will give names, but I'm not going to dwell upon them, Suppot and Aragon, who became a very famous poet, although he was also a communist poet, and became a friend of Matisse's all through the war, and indeed thought he was going to be arrested after the war, but he wasn't. If he was, he was let go pretty quickly.
That would be Louis Aragon.
That's right, yeah. Louis Aragon. So in 1919, he knew enough people to discuss poetry with them and to suggest that they created a journal that they called Literature, Literature. And so in 1919, in March of that year, when he would have been about 23, Literature number one came out, with Aragon and Suppo contributing to it. They also took up L'Autriamont, his poetry, in the first issue. And you remember that he was the person that gave them some images that the Surrealists were going to use, though at that point they probably didn't realize it.
Mm.
And he published a small book called The Magnetic Fields, Les Champs Magnétiques, he and Suppo. So he was moving ahead very fast already. He based some method that he had on what he had read of Pierre Janet.
Right.
Then there was the suicide of his friend Vacher, and then he met Marcel Duchamp and Francis Picabia and became friends of theirs, and at some point even made journeys with them. So by 1920 we have the literature group. It meets on Fridays. It's got Mr. Zara, who had been a member of the Dada group in Zurich.
You mean Tristan Zara?
Yes, Tristan.
Yeah.
And in February they had a Dada bulletin, because it was 1920 and not yet, you know, they were not yet in the mood to kill Dada.
Right.
And so it went. Picabia published Cannibal, that's a little journal of his own, in which he attacks everybody in the first, well, let us say, it was Cannibal was really a lot of tirades criticizing particularly people in politics, but anybody that had occurred to Picabia to criticize. He claims to have met Freud in Vienna, but I doubt it, and I think most people doubt it.
Mm.
Then they started to do such things as create a mock trial for people whose politics they disliked. And the first of these was a famous writer on the right, Maurice Barré. But of course, we should remember that Picabia himself, as a Dadaist, had created a journal of his own called 391. Here you have a situation where people who want to sort of create a new movement, talking with people who had already been Dadaists and were wealthy enough, Picabia was very wealthy, to create Dadaist-type journals. And so we're looking now ahead to something that would finally become La Surrealism in 1924.
Yeah, this is before the communist influence.
At about the same time. Well, yes, yes, before.
Yeah.
It was in 1922 that this journal, Literature, the group began to call themselves Surrealists. And Breton became the editor.
Are these Surrealists in touch with T.S. Eliot, Wyndham Lewis, James Joyce? Is there
I would say absolutely not.
Okay.
They didn't speak English. And although, of course, Eliot had been in France and
yes,
spoke very good French, as far as I know, they had no interest in what the English were doing at all.
All right.
So this is how those few years just prior to the publication of La Révolution Surréaliste began, and the first manifesto was published. This was in 1924.
And this is a dangerous time. You have the right, they murder Rosa Luxemburg. Hitler tries to do a putsch in 1923. There's a real political fight going on, correct?
Yes, but Hitler got arrested. He was sentenced to 5 years.
Yes.
but he was allowed out after 18 months.
Mm.
And while he was in there, he wrote Mein Kampf, of
yes.
course. So, but I don't think yet people are aware of that. They're very much tied up among themselves, and they're now thinking increasingly about psychic automatism and things of that kind,
yeah,
which
yeah.
it's all coming together of how they will recreate poetry of a different kind, pretty well a different kind that's ever been seen in France. Although I must say, there have always been two or three people in the 19th century who were very interesting.
Right.
In the first Surrealist Manifesto, which is generally known as the Freudian Manifesto, they discussed the renaissance of myth and the irrational, the value of dreams, and here they claimed that Freud's Book of Dreams, which had been published about 10 years before, was known, whether again Breton knew it, or whether he had now by this time friends who spoke more than one language. Actually, Apollinaire had spent quite a time in Germany as the tutor to the son of a very wealthy German.
Mm.
He had also fallen in love with someone else who was working for the same man. She was English, and he actually, poor Apollinaire, made overtures to her, but she wasn't interested in him. And we're talking about before the war.
Yes.
It's just a little side note. And he followed her to London, and he found where she lived, and he went to see her. But she basically told him to go away, and so he went away. But he did write a marvelous poem about the sadness that he felt. In any case, he spoke enough German to read Freud, I would think, and he could have done it if there was nobody else.
Right.
So, Value of Automic Techniques by Genet and Freud, and The Marvelous. Well, I mentioned that earlier on. This has been written about for 200 years, and it's to do with the way in which certain paintings are made and certain poetry or books are read. It's actually goes right back to the period before the birth of Christ in the Latin and Greek arenas of the time.
Does the marvelous relate to the sublime?
Yes, it does.
I see, yeah.
Yes, indeed. Sometimes it appears under the name of sublime. I'm just trying to think of the man who famously made that, but his name escapes me, a Frenchman. But it was copied by a British member of the intelligentsia, too. But let's not get too far off
yes.
the main course.
So you're doing the marvelous. Where does
yeah,
that lead?
Yeah, that's right. These are some of the terms that they used. And then they had the definition of surrealism. They called it a noun, a masculine noun. It has to be masculine, of course, for them. And they call it pure psychic automatism, by which is intended to express either verbally or in writing the true function of thought. Thought dictated in the absence of all control asserted by reason and outside all moral and aesthetic considerations. Well, of course, there are some things that they didn't handle, that's for sure, but that's the way they put it.
Mm.
They looked back on the French origins of this kind of thing. They went back to De Sade, to Edgar Allan Poe, to Baudelaire, to Rimbaud, to the poet Mallarmé, to Jarry, and Roussel, whose name we are not going to deal with, but we would if we were talking about Marcel Duchamp.
Yes.
L'Autre Amant, and several others.
When you say Rousseau, you mean the Noble Savage guy or Raymond Rousseau?
Yes, no, Roussel.
Roussel, Raymond. Right?
Roussel, yes, Raymond Roussel.
Yeah.
Who wrote The Voyage to Africa. Is that the correct title? You can correct me if I'm not...
I'm not familiar with that. I'll check it.
It was something that comes up in Duchamp, who knew it very well, and... In my view, and not in anybody, many people that I've ever read about Duchamp, he really did borrow several things from Roussel, who had a little group of people who visited Africa and came across a tribe of rather sophisticated Africans and were entertained by them and reported how they learned from them. One of the things they learned from them, and which Duchamp knew about for sure and sort of practiced, was the way in which music could be made by having a sort of container with some holes in the bottom, tiny holes, that you filled with water, and you put a worm in the water. And as the worm sort of swam back and forth in the wooden box or whatever it was, drops of water came through the holes, and beneath the whole traption there was a zither, and the drops of water dropped on the zither so that you got a tune that was being really generated by a worm in a box.
Wow.
And Duchamp was very aware of that. And the creation of some of the things he did was done rather in the same way.
Here's the title is Raymond Roussel's Impressions of Africa.
Impressions of Africa, that's yeah. Right. I'm glad you're always there to pick me up.
How does Duchamp, does he meet Roussel? Is Roussel still alive? How does this
happen? Oh, yes. Roussel would still have been alive. But I'm not sure, we're taking an aside for a moment.
Yeah.
Whether he actually knew Roussel or not, I'm not sure. Roussel was very wealthy. And when people didn't go to his play, he published it as a book. Duchamp at least read the book. I don't know, I think he actually attended the play. Mm. Now, I might have been with Apollinaire. It might have been with Apollinaire. I would have to check that. But it was after he saw that play and probably understood some of the chance quality that lay behind what happened often that he left Paris and went to Munich for about 6 months. I get my time spans a little bit, but it was something like 6 months. And when he came back, he had with him the plans for the great glass
yes.
that everyone knows that's in Philadelphia.
And did he go to Munich before World War I? In my mind, that's the timing there. 1912?
Yes, it was 1912.
Yeah.
That's right.
He was processing Roussel, but we were talking about the Surrealist Journal and... Breton and Apollinaire, but Apollinaire dies, but you got Breton doing Volume 2, which was the definition of surrealism as automatic psychism or something.
Yes, and we were also saying that by this time, a lot of these rather daring young men were coming together. They must have been meeting frequently and designing something that finally came to be called After Literature, became called surrealism.
Yes.
They invented something called the Surrealist Centrale. This would have been in 1924. We're now talking about the very beginning of surrealism.
Yes.
So they've not only got a journal called La Révolution Surrealiste, which used to be called Littérature, but it's name changed. And now they've got a rather sort of unlikely research office or something like that, but it doesn't appear to be too serious.
Right.
Still, That's what they wanted. They wanted more people to come, and they wanted more talking. There's a group photo of them already as the Surrealist Central. I've never seen it, but there is. And then began a certain sort of old Dada idea of violent rioting against things they didn't like. Even they rioted for their own people. There's a play by Aragon that they didn't like, so they went down and made a fuss with that. It was as if by doing so, they showed that, they weren't giving any virtues to their friends.
Right. You had certain standards you had to meet, or you were, attacked, criticized.
Yep, and that's something that went on in Surrealism, generally led by Breton, who in the end, who after a few years, became a sort of monster man, and who they began to call the Pope, because he would tell people they weren't to appear again.
He'd excommunicate them.
Yes, exactly. And maybe 2 years later, he'd let them back in. Now, I'm not sure how far to go into these riots and things, but in 1925, there was one at a banquet for a poet whose name was Saint-Paul Roux, whom they admired but did not consider as a forerunner of their poetry anyway. And Breton was heard by someone to say, "No French woman could marry a German." And he leapt to his feet and began to lecture her. I'm assuming that Saint-Paul Roux was a woman. I don't know. I don't know very much about the exact position in which they held. But this is the kind of thing that he would suddenly do, stand up and start to shout. A bit like Norman Mailer. I experienced something of the kind in New York with Norman Mailer. I'd love to tell you about it, but not on this particular evening.
Is this something like, artists, surrealist artists' lives matter? You have the present disruption.
Yes, if they're not surrealists, they're not living, and they deserve to be kicked around a bit.
Are they making fun of the actual battles between the left and right, who are seriously, hurting each other, and these guys are riding on abstract principles? That's pretty
neat. Yeah, well, you'd think that the French had no love of the Germans, but some of them would throw stuff and shout, "Long live Germany," just to be different. Tables were overturned. One of them, Soupault, got up to the chandeliers and started swinging on them in the same poetry reading. And Michel Loris, who became a writer and critic, opened the windows of the place. I'm not sure where this place would have been, and shouted, "Down with France."
These are French. They were all
arrested and beaten up by the police. And the newspapers went wild, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So the Surrealists were now seen as traitors. And many papers began a conspiracy of silence about their activities.
Yeah.
And they must have sort of rejoiced in that, I suppose.
Yes. Any attention, even non-attention, is worthwhile.
There were other things of the same kind. There was a Moroccan war. There was a pacifist journal called Clarté, which they at some time disliked but began to join with them. And then came the problem of the beginning of the problems in Russia that they had to sort of begin to deal with, but they hadn't announced themselves yet as friends of the communist revolution.
Right. But they're already, in their weird way, being political.
Yes, but it's more or less being nihilistic, I
think. Yeah.
You know, it's almost destroying themselves. But they certainly didn't want popularity, that's for sure.
Are they reacting to the new world of movies and popular electric media or something? Celebrity world? Is that happening? That's happening to Picasso.
I don't think they are yet. I think they did get involved with one or two small pieces of movie, but that came a bit later, I think.
Are they against Picasso, who's starting to become famous in the early 20s?
No, I think they weren't too much related to Picasso, but as time went by, they would have liked him to join them, and of course he refused.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that his work doesn't seem like surrealism sometimes, course, with twisted bodies and so on.
So what's your point here? We were talking about art allied with poetry, art allied with architecture. Is this surrealism art allied with something else?
No. If you look at a book of surrealist poets, they are very strong, very well known. I mean, you'll scarcely see a name you don't know.
Yeah.
So this is the strongest affiliation with the real poets of the period.
Yes.
It's much more than just Marinetti, and it's much more than those people in Dada. But I think it's still worth having said that they had migrated somehow into where the poets lived rather than into where the architects lived.
Yeah, and Dalí and Salvador Dalí, they're making paintings, right? They are painting, some of them.
Oh, yes. As time goes by, they begin to become recognized. Although I must say, I find it difficult often to accept that I know what a certain painter was doing at a certain time. It is difficult to sometimes differentiate between one of them and another.
Mm.
But, of course, one of the things they didn't want to do was to be accused of copying another, so
yeah.
They had to be on the lookout for that, too. Much more than, for instance, the earlier painters had been in their groups.
Right, so this is interesting. This is a school that's not going to be a school. That's new.
Yes, it is, isn't it? It's a school that uses certain methods to create what it creates. Let me just run down a sort of list of things that we recognize them as inventing in an aid fashion for creating visual art.
Yeah.
Obviously, one of the things they did had relationships to those people that we've mentioned, Janet particularly. So automatic writing, which he had seen some of his patients do, that's what they want to do. So they sort of sit down and create them. And when they'd finished, Breton and a man who is a poet called Soupault, I'm not sure how you actually pronounce it, Soupault.
Yeah.
Or Soupault, but at the time before they actually came up with Surrealism, they had created a book of automatic writing, and they called it The Magnetic Field.
Mm. Yes.
Well, Le Champ Magnifique. I mean, it obviously refers to them being drawn to create poetry in that way. Breton was the editor, and when he'd edited it, Soupault refused to go on with it. So one assumes he hadn't been too kind to Soupault.
Are they influenced by Mesmer's magnetism? Is that a factor there?
No, I think it's a pun on magnetic fields, on the fields of a magnet, you know.
Right, right. And also the electric, the scientists are starting to look into that stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. They'd be aware of Einstein, wouldn't they? They'd certainly be aware of Einstein.
Well, in 1905, they may well be. But, you know, Einstein doesn't seem to appear in any of the books that I have found in connection with them. But that may well be not because they didn't get excited about him, but because the historians didn't think it was relevant to what really their history had to be written.
Right.
Then they did automatic drawing. Well, you can see what that is, and we can all do that. Take a piece of paper and shut our eyes and whatever. Whether they knew it or not, Paul Klee, who was, of course, very, very much in Germany and was in the war, he talked about psychic improvisation in his notebooks in 1908.
Mm.
Now, whether that made any influence to them, it's generally, you know, no one has written about it as far as I know.
Yeah.
But by 1924-25, there's every reason why they should have, by then, heard about Klee. Not that, you know, maybe not. Let me add to that, because Arp was German, I believe. I should know that he is, but...
Hans Arp, A-R-P.
Yes, A-R-P. And he knew of Klee, of course. And it may well have been that if it was in 1908 that Klee had written that, that the cabaret people and the others also... I'm feeling a little bit faint, actually. Let me just fairly quickly say that the painter Masson created, with some others, automatic drawing when he joined them.
And then they would display these in galleries, and that would be really outrageous, that people were drawing blindfolded, so to speak.
Yes, exactly.
So they're doing this stuff. It's pretty obscure. It's not till after World War II when university professors start excavating the first half of the 20th century that a big deal is made out of these people, or are they really getting attention? You say the newspapers cover them, but then they did a blackout of them. How much going into the 30s are they noticed by the average middle-class person?
Oh, I think increasingly. Now, not increasingly in crowds of people, but increasingly because they began to have shows, exhibitions. And not only that, but they were in decent galleries. There weren't many of them. And besides, now they were well known for the curiosity value, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I think as time went on, until the Second World War began, they had achieved a certain level. In fact, not long before the Second World War began, they came to London and had a show there, and they were very welcomed.
Well, that brings up Peggy Guggenheim. She was a big mover and shaker there. Is there much you would say about her?
Well, she was certainly around, and she must certainly have met them.
Yes.
And she was buying stuff. Just what she bought is not clear to me. I mean, there was Picasso and Matisse to buy. There was Mondrian and company, so that she may well have bought Salvador Dali. I don't know. And she had begun to do that just before the Second World War. Well, I guess more than that, maybe 4 or 5 years before the Second World War.
Yes.
She knew some of the highlight individuals, like Herbert Read in England and so on.
And I know she was a friend, a regular, you know, meeter with James Joyce and also Marcel Duchamp.
Yes, so exactly. You know, the chances that she was putting together, with the help of people like Duchamp, a reasonably valuable collection has to be noted. But, of course, they weren't, I think, asking money out of this world. they were probably ready to take quite reasonable amounts.
Yes.
I don't know, I'm guessing. Picasso, I think, would probably charge, be able to charge more than any surrealist at that time.
Mm.
Now, what happened after the war is another matter. Then they were taken up in New York, and they became international, and books were written about them, and so on.
Why do you think that they got enamored with communism? Is it stated why? Why they moved that in direction? Is it because many intellectuals were doing that anyways?
Yes, I think that in that period, really until just before the Second World War, when Stalin became a very dirty fellow.
Yeah.
I mean, he destroyed a lot of his army, high-level people.
Yeah.
He was taken by surprise, therefore, when Germany invaded him. He didn't expect it, but he got rid of people who he feared. And he did that all the time. In fact, as you may know, the man who created the defense of St. Petersburg during the war and was a great Russian hero, he invited him to Moscow and had him shot when he arrived.
Right. He would not let anybody else get influenced. Stalin would not let anybody become a hero.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. You know, just how people took to it. He had already told Trotsky to get out.
Yeah.
And he hadn't killed him, but he said, don't come back to Russia. So the surrealists did try to make some contact with him in
Mexico?
Yes, Mexico, of course, yes.
Yeah, that would be through those Remedios Varo and Carrington and a few others, female artists, would be interested in Trotsky probably, because some of them had been lovers of surrealists before they went to Mexico.
Yes, indeed.
But let's go back. So are we still? Is there still more to say before the communist influence comes over?
I think we're not going to do more than say they had a lot of problems once they had announced their devotion in the second set of their journal that they were ready to help the revolution. But I think that caused internal differences as well as a suspicion from the right and so on.
Right.
In France.
And is that largely due to Breton getting interested in communism? Is he forcing people to think about it, or are there others genuinely agreeing with him in the surrealist movement?
I don't know whether it would work that way. His reputation was that he was really running a group. So if he said, look, it's time we backed up the communist revolution and backed it up in a sense, I suppose, in case it should start in France. I would think people then had to, the people around him had then to make their minds up.
Right.
But maybe they did make their minds up to stay with him and do that. I can't answer that.
Did Salvador Dali leave them at that point? Was he
too? Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
Dali was one of those that Breton got rid of and then received back and so on.
And Duchamp is cagey. He's able to be diplomatic and mingle with all kinds of groups.
Yes, he does. And that's because of his curious temperament. He can see it really pays. And he's certainly not, I mean, the last thing a Duchamp's going to do is be listening to Breton tell him what to do. Obviously. But, I mean, he wouldn't barge in and express his annoyance with Breton. He'd just not be there.
Yeah.
In fact, Breton was avid to get Duchamp as a member of the Surrealist movement.
Say it again. He was what?
He would have loved to have
Duchamp.
And he made offers to him, of course. And he invited him to their shows. They had two big shows, really. One just before the war and one just after it. Actually, just after it. I'm not absolutely certain it wasn't before the end of it. But in any case, he not only accepted the invitation to join them for these two big shows, but he embarrassed them, or tried to. Now, of course, they were playing a game which meant that his attempts to embarrass them must not be allowed to be seen. So, but you can tell. I mean, in the they had a big show in 1938. It was the first really, really big show with everybody there and so on. And Duchamp was invited. What did he do? He ordered, and I don't know the number, but it was probably about 2,000 coal bags, used coal bags, to be suspended from the ceiling of the whole of the place that where they were showing their work.
This was in London?
No, it was in Paris.
Oh, okay.
And that was to be adorned with a pseudo, what do they call those things in the street where they burn wood or coal or something for the homeless, or they used to,
yes,
for the homeless to crowd around.
But what about that? If you don't have the name, but they use those? That
well,
became part of the exhibition?
He faked one.
Hmm.
I mean, he had all the stuff, but of course he put an electric light inside and had a red, so that it looked like one of those things.
Right.
So beneath his ceiling of sacks of coal, there was a fire waiting to be stoked.
Like in a barrel.
That's right.
Yeah.
Something like that. He did afterwards admit that he didn't have any coal in those bags. He stuffed them with paper or something and it looked like coal.
Well, who put them all up there? If you have 2,000, who did the
work? I have
work?
No idea. I mean, this is, they had to pay for it, I should think. I don't.
Yeah.
I really don't know. But after that, after the war, or just before the end of the war, I'm not sure what it was. I should have looked that up. But they had another show. Duchamp again tried to embarrass them by using what he put out to be 7 miles of string that he simply laced up all over the place in the exhibition space so that people couldn't move around. But you can't help thinking that the idea, when it appears in photos, looks as if they really couldn't get around. Whereas, in fact, it only looked as if they couldn't get around, and well, indeed, they couldn't get close to some works and so on, but they could at least, they could walk around and see the works.
Like a labyrinth.
Yes, sometimes very close, sometimes not.
If he's trying to bug them, and they're letting him do that, they'd like to have him trying
well,
to...
Well, you see, I think he knew, I mean, suppose he had painted a beautiful portrait of some person and sent that in. I mean, they might have put their foot through it. But if he brings 1,000 sacks of coal or whatever the number was, it was a large number, you know, they daren't say, take it away.
Right.
I mean, they would be criticizing themselves for wanting to be clean and proper. And he wanted them to grin and bear it, you know. So they grinned and beared it. I think, actually, Dali had the second most interesting piece in there because he had a taxi driven in, and he had the inside of the taxi so arranged that he would circulate water inside it, squirting all over the place, but not coming out of it
right.
You know, forcing people to walk through water.
Now, these incidents you're talking about, Duchamp and Dali, would you have learned about that in art school in London in the early 50s?
No. Nothing.
Are you one of the early scholars with Hamilton when you went around with the green box in the late 60s across Canada and that? That was the beginning of finding out these kind of antics?
Well, no, because as a student, after I left the college, I joined the Institute of Contemporary Art.
Yes.
And they were already interested in Duchamp. So it was like a free advanced art school, if you like.
Yeah.
I learned quite a lot there that I think it's fair to say could never have been learned in any college of art in England at that time.
Right, right.
It's an extraordinary situation.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
I wonder if I could just continue just to give us some idea of their methods. They had something called surrealist games, games of consequences, transferred to drawing. Now, the first one of these that one night they produced, they pass a piece of paper around and then it's folded over. So the first person that had it wrote "the exquisite." The next one happened to write "corpse." And the next one wrote "shall drink." The next one wrote "the young." And the last one wrote "wine." So that the whole thing read, actually, "the exquisite corpse shall drink the young wine." You'd think that they'd invented that before they sat down, wouldn't you?
Mm.
I can't quite believe. But they called the rest of those games they played, "let's have a game of exquisite corpse again."
I have a book, a collection of that activity.
Ah, yes, really?
Yeah, it's an exquisite corpse, I think the book is called.
And, of course, the same thing is applied. It's a commonplace. You take a piece of paper, partly make a drawing, and then fold it over and just leave the places where you left off with your pencil and pass it on to the next person.
Right.
What comes out of that is often just, boring, I think.
Yeah, so here they are, a school that doesn't want to be a school, but they are exchanging communal forms of communication.
Somehow they are, but you can't invent a picture of them all sitting down together. You can imagine two or three of them in a room saying, "let's try this one, see what happens," and so on. I'm not sure whether they ever had a meeting where there was a sort of a list of things that they wanted to discuss or something.
Right, so it was spontaneous.
Spontaneous.
Yeah.
And then they would, of course, publish it in the journal.
You know the book, The Meaning of Meaning? I think it's by Ogden and Richards, that had a big influence on Marcel Duchamp. Was he unique in reading that book, or were the surrealists reading what Duchamp was reading?
Oh, I don't know.
Don't know that book.
The surrealists were obviously very intelligent people. Some of them spoke more than one language, and they were scattered about quite a bit.
Hmm.
I don't know how many times they might have met as a whole group. Maybe never, you know?
Yes.
So I can't answer the question. I would think that a lot of them were very bright people, and they read the news like everybody else, and even read problematic books that were difficult to, you know, get very far with. I mean, it's not anybody who could read what Einstein had
right.
written.
Right.
So they had these strange games. They had one called the Game of Truth. I played that once and got shocked by what happened. You ask someone about somebody else. It goes something like this. Well, the worst thing about Dennis Young is, and then the next person is supposed to fill the next line. You know.
And you got shocked by what they came up with?
I got shocked by it because somebody said, "is that he will not hold his tongue?" And I knew why. It's because I've insulted his wife. She deserved it, but I'm sure that was the reason. Actually, she's a good friend of mine, so it didn't matter.
Is this in the 50s?
Oh, I did it in probably the 80s.
In Halifax.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then they had what they called projective techniques. Leonardo had one. He told his pupils to, if they got stuck a bit, throw a sponge of something full of color, throw it at the wall and then see what you can make of it. He understood that you sometimes needed help. And we had an artist whose name was Cousins, who was a delightful watercolorist, who did the same. And of course, to some extent, Rorschach, who died young in 1916, but he was someone who created a test by which he claimed to be able to analyze you psychologically. Then they had frottage, which was rubbing. You put down a piece of paper on a dirty pathway or something and rubbed it, or you put it on a clean path and on a table and you rubbed on it, and what you got, for instance, was often the print of the wood beneath it.
Right.
And you can still do that today. Max Ernst did quite a few of those things using a wood floor. There's also a decalomania, which was like using decals that you invented.
Yes.
And posted onto your work. There's fumage, which was to hold a smoking something underneath your canvas and let the smoke do something for you. There was coulage, which was pouring paint onto the canvas and often then making something from it.
That's before Jackson Pollock?
Yes, oh yes. In fact, you might say that Pollock knew enough about it for it to have been an influence on him.
Yes, he was a student of the Surrealists, wasn't he? He was very fascinated
by
them.
Yes, he was interested in the Surrealists for sure.
Yeah.
But I don't think he was interested in all this psychic stuff. For him, well, it's difficult to come up with what his aim was, but he doesn't seem to have wanted to play games with it so much as to allow himself challenges from which he made pictures, you know.
Okay, listen to this. Speaking of the psyche part, Carol and I and some friends met in Paris the end of September, 1st of October, you know, a few months ago, and we went to Leonardo da Vinci's little castle that King Francis I gave him in 1516. He was there for about 3 years, and he died in 1519. So we went through the museum of, you know, Da Vinci artifacts, and we came to the workroom, and they had, I think it's even published, I have a collection of sketches and stuff by Leonardo da Vinci. Now, this was the original sketch manuscript, and we approach it, and there on one of the page exposed from like the middle of the book is the pattern, what's called the Corinthian column or the Doric column. They have a little flower fleur-de-lis kind of thing at the top of the column. So we use that in our RNA drops bottle. So we had been going to all these castles and documenting the use of this little plant effluence at the top of the columns. So now we're into Leonardo da Vinci's workshop late afternoon, and the manuscript is open to that sketch, the sketch of the flowering at the top of a Doric or Corinthian column. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes.
So we had been talking to Ion, a phenomenon through a medium, every night after we go to these museums. And so, of course, we said, Ion opened the page for our little design to be seen. So we talked to Ion on the phone that night through the medium we call JW, and Ion said, yes, we did open the manuscript to that page so you could see your own pattern that you use on your health bottles. So how's that for psychic surrealistic retrieval?
Right.
and then we were walking. This is in a place called Amboise, A-M-B-O-I-S-E. We're walking around after we left the Leonardo's castle, and this man comes by us, and he walks up to the wall. There's this wall of houses embedded into the caves, or cave houses as part of the environment of Amboise. We ask if we could take a picture, and we move closer, and then he says, well, why don't you come in? So he took us a tour through his cave house in the wall of the mountain, okay, in Amboise. Eventually, he starts telling us, out of the blue, he says, you know, it's well known locally that Leonardo da Vinci didn't die. There's no bones in his grave here in Amboise, or wherever the grave is. So he begins to tell us a story about Leonardo da Vinci is alive and about, and that is what Ian had told us 3 weeks before. So how's that for a punchline?
I don't know. I mean, I guess you must have had a wire going between you or something.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I didn't know you'd get into this aspect of the interest in mediumship and the psychic. I knew about automatic writing, but you've brought in a little bit of the psychic stuff that Genet was studying. And we were doing this in Paris just a couple months ago. And those events unfolded. And then you mentioned Leonardo da Vinci.
That's a fascinating story.
The other thing is that the guy told us that Joan of Arc, there's no bones of her in her supposed grave. So anyways, talking to this guy, it turned out he had done this gig a lot. He had a big stack of letters from people that had visited the Leonardo da Vinci Museum and then bumped into him, and he would take him into his wall cave home and talk about whatever his collection of stuff, World War II stories, because many of the inhabitants of Amboise survived by going into the caves when they were being bombed by the Germans. So this guy actually had a whole gig. So then we found out from Ion that he saw us at the castle was Chenonceau, and he followed us home. He found us interesting, and he followed us home, and he made himself visible to us on purpose so that he could invite us into his cave. And he told us about Leonardo da Vinci was still around, still alive. At least his bones weren't around. So how's that? There it is. That's a good surrealistic story.
Well, I'll see if I can follow up with a few more things about the surrealists in general.
Okay.
I'll just refer to some of the sort of problems that they were trying to solve, which were, in a way, human problems, too. One was freedom, personal freedom, subjective freedom, as much as political freedom. This, of course, had been Hugo Ball, the Dadaist. That had been his aim as well. Much of their activity had that element in it, and sexual freedom was certainly one of them. Hallucination and dreams were part of it. The idea of suicide was even part of it, the freedom to do away with yourself. And then they had this nonsense business with communism, which was shaky, as I've said, because of the way people would leave them and maybe come back in a couple of years to see what's happening.
Did they do psychedelic drugs?
I would think it's quite possible that they did, but what they were, I don't know.
Mm.
Their first historian, Maurice Nadeau, thought that behind their surrealism and their sort of efforts was a deep despair of attaining freedom.
Mm.
And that what they were doing was attempting to find ways in which you could conquer that despair by a sort of desperate humor, for one of the things.
Yes.
Jarry's pataphysics, Vacher's, who wrote something about humor. I didn't study Vacher, so I don't know what his humor was, but it sounds like humor.
Is this anticipating Mad Magazine?
Oh, I don't know about that. Perhaps it is.
Well, isn't part of this crisis of identity or of thought or of will, because the machine, what Guy Debord would call the spectacle later, was they were responding to the media spectacle, right, which would threaten the creative impulse in their old-fashioned terms, what I call the Gutenbergian creativity?
I don't know. There was certainly a lot of eroticism in what they said. Whether there was a lot of eroticism in what they did is another matter. They had something called amour fou.
Yeah.
That mad love. And to a certain extent, you could talk of the cult of the erotic female, which was at the heart of surrealism. But what you can't do is find the females. You know, it's as if, they would talk that way. But how did they set about it? I don't know, unless they, you know, went out to the red light district or something. I mean, clearly they wanted women companions, but then everybody wants women companions who are erotic. I mean, I don't know that by emphasizing this in what they said, they were, you know, they were getting much further.
And you're saying we don't know, or we know that they weren't homosexuals?
Well, that's it. That's the one thing they refused. For instance, in Rambo's case, they were sure that he was homosexual with Elaine, at the very least.
Right.
And maybe that's one reason why he went to Africa. Who knows?
Right.
But they found Rambo unacceptable as a homosexual. I mean, you might even say they were unconsciously homosexual and they couldn't sort of free themselves to be homosexuals.
Yeah, I see.
No.
But that you're saying that was a taboo in surrealism. For all their efforts to be free, they wouldn't tolerate that.
Yes, that's true. That really is. They had a muse. The muse came when they discovered an essay by Freud about a novel that he read in which an archaeologist falls in love with a carved relief of a girl, and he calls her Gradiva. And there's much to say about Gradiva in the surrealist goings-on. It was because of the way she seemed to walk with a limp in this carving.
Yeah.
And later, he dreamt, that is to say, in the story, by a guy called Wilhelm Jensen in 1903. So he called her Gradiva for the way she walked. Later, he dreamt that she died in Pompeii in the Great Explosion.
Right, 2,000 years ago.
So he went to Pompeii, and when he got there, there was a girl sitting on the side of the Pompeii street that looked exactly like her.
Wow.
When she sees him and he wants to talk to her, she says, "Oh, I remember you. I was a child playmate whose memory you've forgotten." So the archaeologist's amorous feelings repressed and diverted to his science can find expression healthily now that the repressed memory is restored.
Mm.
So by going there, he had sort of got rid of this repressed memory, and he was that much healthier. Now, Freud made a lot of fuss about that, about the story and about the author's insights into that kind of experience, being buried in Pompeii and
Yeah.
Like memory is in your head is buried beneath so much.
Yeah.
But it led to the paintings of Gradiva. Masson particularly painted her, a sort of turning her in a way into a Pygmalion, like the story of that.
The rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain.
Yeah, that's right. When Breton himself invented a gallery for himself, and he asked Duchamp to design the doors, Duchamp's design for the doors was to put the two figures from this story of the two in Pompeii.
Right.
And so when you walked in, you walked past Gradiva, who was the muse of the artists who had brought works to be seen.
I've never heard that fact before. That's pretty interesting. Is that well known or in?
Well, it is. It is to people who, I guess, to historians, but
yeah,
not too many people outside. But of course, Freud wrote an essay on this book, so it probably is better known by the shrinks of the world than by the others.
Do you want to end on that point, or do you have a wrap-up sentence? What are we going to do next?
Well, I think that we've spoken about several of the methods they used to be free. It wasn't always the best way, but they wanted to exercise their unconscious all the time.
Right.
Find what was there and to release what was there and feel the better for it. But because it was always erotic, we don't know, really, whether they were just talking about it or whether they'd found a way of living it.
Yes.
I think that there was a lot of fuss about the erotic. In a certain way, you might say, well, Duchamp saw them and talking about the erotic, but not being able to manage it. I'll show them how to manage it.
Yeah.
I'm going to write a piece about Duchamp's lubricity very shortly.
All right.
And in Duchamp, it was all over the place.
Yes.
None of their works was it all over the place. It wasn't even all over the place with the poets, although I'm not a great, I haven't read a lot of their poetry. It's just too much to read, and it's in a language which I don't find it absolutely easy, especially when the writers are people with a great, vast vocabulary in their own language.
Right, so are we going to do Duchamp next?
We could do Duchamp, why not, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, Dennis. Thanks a lot.
Goodbye.
Okay, bye.